Welcome to the Research Studio, the place where we talk to current doctoral students involved in practice-based, practice-led, or practice-informed research in the arts. My name is Dr. Mark Wilshire, and I'm based at Norwich University of the Arts in the UK. I'm an artist and academic involved in doctoral supervision, and I want to use my experience of making artworks and exhibitions to think about the different roles that creative practice can play within academic research. Clementine Bedos is a transmedia artist currently based in London. Drawing from a diverse ancestry and a background in law, philosophy, and fine arts, their practice explores the interrelated phenomena of mind, body, and consciousness within hegemonic systems of identity. Rooted in embodied research and interdisciplinary collaboration, they create site-sensitive installations and performances that hold ancestral, diasporic, and esoteric knowledge systems in tension with extended reality technologies. Activating the frictions and unexpected similarities between divergent ontologies as a form of creolized resistance and epistemic disobedience. The work reorients aesthetic focus inward, reclaiming the body, its sensuality and inner visuality as sites of emancipation and non-duality. Recent projects include Your Rage is Sacred, Ma, at former HQ and Goldsmith's Sonic Immersive Media Lab in 2023-24, Metamorph at Eastside Projects, Birmingham in 2024, and Loving Fugitives Runaway Images at Van Gogh House in 2023. Bedos was recently awarded a fully funded residency with La Huaca Current Atacama Desert in Chile in 2025 and the Immersive Arts Expand Grant for their collaborative project Breathscapes. They serve as chair of the Artist Council at AN, the Artist Information Company, leading artist advocacy nationally and internationally. They are also part of the senior tutors team at the Ruskin School of Art, University of Oxford, and about to enter a writing up year of PhD study at Goldsmiths, University of London. Welcome, Clementine.
Welcome, thank you.
Really great to meet you. Thanks for having me in your studio today. Well, first of all, maybe you could just tell us the title, your current working title for your PhD research, because it's a really fascinating title.
Oh, thank you. And the title of my PhD is called Technotantric Embodiment, Navigating Oppression and Resistance Through the Creolization of Ancestral and Emerging Technologies. So it's a bit long and wordy, but it makes sense to me. And I've actually stuck to it from the beginning. Mm. It has remained the same.
I think PhD titles have to be long and wordy.
Oh, okay.
There's a rule.
That's fine. Yeah.
So how did you, is this an area that you have been interested in for 10 years, or is it a new kind of thing for you? Mm. I mean, specifically the sort of the techno-tantric axis.
Yeah, thank you for this question. Yes, so, you know, I'm neurodivergent, and I've got many interests. And, you know, my mind is like a sprawling octopus. And so I've been wanting to do a PhD for a long time. I don't know why, like, to be fair. I just always loved theory, philosophy, concepts, ideas, words. I love them. And so, yes, I think, you know, when I was looking at my peers, some artists I really value and respect, like Linda Stupart, I don't know if you know them, really amazing artist, performer, thinker, theorist as well. And they were doing PhDs, and this was something that appealed to me for some reason. And I guess there was also the stability that it came with it, because as an artist that is a non-commercial artist, like, you know, my practice is research-based and experimental, it's kind of difficult to sustain a lifestyle in London currently. And so it also came with this idea of having some kind of stability too, because the idea was I was going to do it funded. You know, I wouldn't do it if it was not funded. And so when I was trying to kind of conceptualize and think about a project that could hold me for 3 years, minimum 3 years, I had to think it needs to hold all of my interests, you know, it needs to be something that I can sustain for 3 years, because knowing me, I will change, you know, I will change my interest and I will not be able to sustain my energy and focus during that amount of time, you know, because I was in lockdown in London. Luckily, actually, I was on my own. I spent a lot of that time to gather my thoughts, my thinking, and to bring all of this together and articulate basically all of my interest in this project that is, again, quite experimental, and took a broad guess or leap of faith in applying to the PhD, and I was really surprised by the response, actually really positive response from the art department, who got really excited about the project and actually took it in very interesting directions. Because initially my project was mainly focused on the body, on ancestral spiritual practices, ancestral spiritualities, because this is what really saved me, and I really felt a call to share those practices. And when I proposed the project to Goldsmiths, actually they read it more on the technological side, which was quite interesting. And so, I mean, my practice has always been digital in some regards, like, you know, I'm not denying the fact that I was always using digital technologies, but for me that was not the core of the project. But the way they read it, they proposed Audrey Sampson, who was the head of the digital practice program at the time. Now she left and she's at Ecole Graphique in Brussels. And she proposed to have my second supervisor in the computing department. So actually I was really excited to see that, because that gave me access to all these facilities, you know. So when I started looking at the computing department, I saw they had this like 360 projection environment, motion capture, all these things. So it kind of expanded my imagination and the possibilities that I could explore during this research.
And you, I mean, the project is pretty esoteric in some ways, with its emphasis on interior states and embodiment and tantra. How was the university with that? Were they kind of very accepting of that and open to sort of the subject matter?
Yeah, interestingly, I think that's my naivety, because at the time, you know, it comes from such authentic place. That for me, I didn't really expect that there could be some, resistance. They really embraced it, and I think they were really interested in it. It's more when I kind of started delving into it and trying to get funding to support the development, the production of the works. That's where I encountered more resistance around the, you know, and that's when I realized, now, you know, if you look at how I communicate about the artworks that are emerging from this project, I often remove the word tantra.
Right. Okay.
Yes, because there's so much misunderstanding. And particularly, I think, in this current time where Neo-Tantra is really emerging as part of the wellness industry, and also the, you know, social network and digital platforms. There is a lot of misunderstanding of what Tantra is. And I think also particularly in a UK context that still is grappling with its colonial history, and I think has still a lot of stigma against like Indian philosophies. And there was a big exhibition, I think now I'm not going to get the time right, maybe, but I think 20 years back, it was exactly when I applied in 2020.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was exactly 20 years anniversary of that big show at the Hayward Gallery called Tantra.
Okay.
So there is a history in this country of like...
That's pretty establishment, isn't it? The Hayward. Yeah.
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 No, and I mean, there's a big tantric philosophy center at the at Oxford University, actually. Not the Ruskin, sorry. For the Center for Hindu Studies as well. So it's actually, there's a lot of research around Tantra in this country, but somehow, you know, surprisingly, you can have like big theories that still kind of think Tantra is sex. You know, I encountered that. So it's really kind of like, oh, you know, surprising that still the stigma can be, yeah, in some people, you don't expect it.
Could you say a little bit about how you understand Tantra then? Like, what's your kind of take on it, or understanding? Or, well, your kind of embodied understanding of it, I guess. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. Yes. So there's several things to say about this, because I also come, my positionality towards Tantra is very specific. The Tantra I have access to is definitely not the Tantra. I mean, Tantra is so vast. So I would say that it's an ancestral science. It has its origin in tribal knowledge, medieval India, and you know, this is also the text that we have, the tantras, but its origin is far beyond that, you know. So it's really tribal knowledge, like knowledge that is grounded in animistic understanding of reality, where basically our ancestors were, you know, were not considering themselves separated from nature. They understood like the forces of nature as something that was traversing themselves, their own body and spirit. And so it's really a science. It's really deep, actually. It's really complex. But it's a whole philosophy that understands reality with different realms, different levels, that understand the self as also sort of like Russian doll with lots of layers. And at the core of the self is basically non-dual consciousness, which is also what is outside, you know? So it's really like so above, as below, so above.
So kind of at the center there's just unity with everything, oneness, no duality.
Exactly. And Tantra, so it really emerged at a time in India, in medieval India, at a time of crisis, where people really needed new tools to, like, I mean, emerged. That's when it really expanded and got lots of patrons as well, to really get developed, and it was really embraced by, you know, the kings and the power in place. But it was really originated to be spread beyond caste, gender. Like, it was open to all, and this was really in response also to Brahmanical power, which is a bit like, basically, if you don't understand really the caste system in India, it's kind of like hetero-colonial patriarchy in a way. It's like these priests that kind of like create this idea that they have the supreme knowledge and that certain things can't be accessed by all, including women. And so, you know, Tantra is really conceived as practices of empowerment that can empower all. And it spread all across India. You know, there's forms of Tantra, Buddhist Tantra, tantric forms in Tibet, in Korea, in Japan, but also moved with diasporic people, diasporic movements. And so my relation to Tantra is through my grandmother. My grandmother is what is called an outsider artist. I put the commas because I don't relate to this word. It's, I mean, in France we call art brut, which is basically, we say l'art des fous, the art of the mad. But, you know, it's a category that was created by Jean Dubuffet. And it's this idea of people that were not trained, you know, with institutions and academically, and also, you know, art of children. And so it's kind of a broad category of marginalized people, I guess. Also, I guess, people with learning difficulties, all of that. So there's quite a lot of stigma around that. But anyway, my grandmother was, I guess she's considered an outsider artist because she spent most of her life sectioned in a mental asylum for being diagnosed with schizophrenia. And my understanding of it is, you know, she was a very vulnerable person. She was an orphan, and she, you know, she was living in a caravan selling roses in the streets, and, you know, she was a gitane. She called herself a gitane. So in English we say gypsy, which is, I know, is quite problematic in this country, but she identified as gitane. And so anyway, my grandmother, she spent all these years in mental asylum drawing these multicolored flowers, these mandalas. And she would, you know, draw day and night. And she had this very specific ritual where at the beginning of the day, she would write the date. So she will have a paper with the dates. Mm. And then she will draw all day, sign every drawing and title them. And so, you know, these, like, you have these myriads of multicolored mandalas and flowers, and she would, like, then send them, wrap them in, like, and brown and white envelopes and send them by post to my mother, my aunt, and myself. And so I have an archive of thousands of them. And for me, you know, as a little girl already, because we had some of her paintings at home and I would receive those drawings, but I could see the stigma from the family, from the community, especially my father. And I could not understand it because I actually identified with her. Mm. And I loved her so much, you know, grandmother. Who doesn't like their grandmother?
Did you see her?
Yes, see her a lot? Yeah. I would go and spend time with her. I would see her. Sometimes she would be out of mental asylum and come, it was a bit of back and forth. But I spent a lot of time thinking, you know, those flowers, this visual language that was really a loving visual language, stayed with me. And I think that kind of contrast between, on the one hand, the loving message that my grandmother was sending and sharing through her drawings, and the how it was received with so much violence and so much violence and mépris. I don't know what's this word in English. You know, when people despise you, you know. And for me, I think that tension, you know, is really a state with me, is really at the core. But anyway, when I went to art school, when I went to study at Goldsmiths on my BA in fine arts, I guess because I was far away from home, what stayed with me was her drawings. And so I started to really look at them and really try to decipher this message, because in a way it was kind of our primal mode of communication and a non-traditional mode of communication. And so I was trying to understand, what was that language? And where does that come from? And because she was separated from her community, it's not like I saw my grandmother in her gypsy community and I could be like, oh yes, that's cultural and da da da. I had to kind of make that journey myself by deciphering the drawings. And so that's what led me to Tantra. But in parallel, I was going through my own healing journey of, you know, actually being raised in a sort of Catholic background with, you know, a lot of stigma around the body, around what is to be raised or identified as a female body. And so I had also to reconcile myself with that. And so it's, I think, really interesting because, I don't know, I'm jumping now ahead, but through my research, I did, for example, some field work in the south of France. I went to the pilgrimage, the gypsy pilgrimage, the Sainte Marie de la Mer, it was so fascinating because suddenly everything made total sense. You know, I could join all the dots and it was like a aha moment because they celebrate. So it's one of the biggest gypsy pilgrimage. That happens on the 24th of May every year in near Arles, in this little village called Sainte-Marie-de-la-Mer, which is by the sea. And there is this church where in the underground of the church is Sarah Lacali. And Sarah Lacali, she's a syncretism of Sarah, a sort of non-canonized virgin, saint, and Kali, the Hindu goddess. And so it's really amazing, like you have this kind of cowboy that kind of guard the city, that kind of carry the crowd. And so first of all, you arrive, you go underneath the church, and you feel this like heat of all the candles in the space, and you queue to wrap some fabric around Sarah Lacali, around this figure, this statue. And people have stitched like what you can call mantras or prayers, wishes, spells. And they wrap her, and so at the end this little sculpture becomes like really, really big, with layers of hundreds of like layers of fabric from all the people that comes to celebrate her. And so she comes out all wrapped. So again, it's like this doll, right? You know, where I was telling you about the self being like all these layers. And she comes out, and these cowboys are kind of guiding the crowd to the sea, and then she's submerged. And this really echoes some of the tantric rituals in India. So you can see how gypsy communities in some ways, who originate like thousands of years ago, originate from India, have kept some of the, have maintained some of those practices through syncretism. Yeah. So it was a really long, but that's to say that I have a very specific understanding of Tantra. It's not, you know, I was raised in France.
Yeah.
And my entry point is through my grandmother and through my own healing journey. Mm. But why I was saying the tension with Catholicism, which is really interesting actually, that I've really experienced in Sainte-Marie-de-la-Mer, is that was actually fascinating. So for the festival, which is 3-4 days, the doors of the church were fully open. And you had, you know, the gypsy community coming in and out to go into the crypt of the church. Well, meanwhile, you have the priest that is trying to kind of celebrate those saints that are held in the ceiling of the church. So you really have that tension between the sort of tantric belief that is underground, that is really about the core of matter, about darkness. Darkness not as like obscure occult force, but darkness as a field of possibility. And then you have, you know, Catholicism, which believes in like a sort of kind of spirit that is above ground, you know. And I think here there's a real tension of philosophies and understanding of reality, something that is disembodied, that is really high and kind of actually despises the body, and something that is really rooted in earth belief.
Fascinating. The idea of embodiment, I think, is really fascinating when it relates to expanded reality, as we talk about it these days through technology. Because I've always thought, and in fact I've written about, virtual reality, expanded reality, and how there needs to be a kind of like a language of embodiment and sort of situatedness in relation to it. Otherwise it just becomes, in my opinion, an incredibly kind of, you know, patriarchal technology, essentially.
Yeah.
So it'd be great to hear your thoughts on that and how you are dealing with and kind of confronting the technological and the power, this kind of like determinative power of technology and capitalism through your work. Oh, that's a big question.
Yeah, really big question. You know, my work is really grounded in my personal experience, and my methodologies are grounded in, you know, what I need. I observe what I need, and I basically, you know, it's this sentence of like, you know, create what you can't see, you know, you need to make it. Larry at Champagnon. This is a sentence that Larry at Champagnon repeats a lot, you know, if you don't see it, do it. And I think I really go by that. And for me, as I said, as I started, I could, in my upbringing, there was a lot of disembodiment. Something that really marked me, you know. And through my, I was guided, I'm so lucky that I was guided towards the body, towards reconciliating, a reconciliation with the body, with my body. And when I entered my body, which was actually the first time I entered my body, was in 2019 at a Vipassana meditation course. So Vipassana meditation course, they're like 10 days where you sit in meditation for about 10 hours a day. And I think around the second or third day, I suddenly was like, oh, I'm now in my body. For the first time.
For the first time in your life. Wow. Mm.
So disembodiment is a real thing, like, you know, dissociation as well. Mm. It's like, you know, and that's why my work is so grounded in also marginalized communities, because we are not facing the same circumstances, you know, like we are not facing the same risk in this colonial regime, like in heterocolonial patriarchy, you know, this society. And the amount of harm and things that happen to you throughout your life that basically, of course, lead you to dissociation, because it is not safe to be in a brown body, in a female body, in a queer body. It is not safe. So it's a survival mechanism to dissociate. And the journey to go back in the body, to go back in the crypt, is a scary one. You need to be held. You need containers, safe containers. You need to be guided. You need to be cared for. You need protocols. You need rituals. And so this is what I'm trying to create with the work. I don't know if it's helpful to go into more details into like.
I think maybe you could tell us about something that you have made recently, or something which would illustrate that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just to continue with the technology side, the kind of emerging technology, the kind of Silicon Valley technologies that are being sold to us, and big tech is really putting so much resources to make them ubiquitous. You know, I was telling you before about the VR headset, which you can already see sometimes, like some videos online of people like being in a cafe and you have someone wearing an Apple Vision Pro, you know, because now they have the pass-through thing. So it's really surreal. But I still believe that this VR headset is really the incarnation, like, of that, you know, what I was telling you, that kind of like separation, this thing that is disembodied, this idea that the kind of head or the top, or the, like, you know, off-ground perspective is the one, you know, something that is really rational. Like, for me, there's so many things in modernity, in modernist thinking, that shows you that how, like, you know, the body has started to be dismissed, and how, you know, we put all our focus in reason, in, you know, our brain. I don't have any other way to say that.
A word you've also used is oculocentrism.
Mm-hmm. So that's the thing. It's like, on the one hand is the head, is the brain, which for me, it's an analytic tool. Like, it's not supposed to guide us through reality. I think really what Tantra teaches you is that we're supposed to be guided by the heart. That's what pulsates, that's what creates your magnetic field, that's what, you know, if we believe that we're in a reality that is energy, or lots of energies, this is basically the center of energy, and this is what should guide us, and this is what connects us. The brain is an analytic tool, but in those technologies, it becomes, therefore, and this, you can see that also in the history of art, how with the creation of perspective, is this idea that it's an illusion that has been created that reality exists outside of the observer, as if we're just like outside of the field that we're observing, as if we're not in dialogue, in symbiotic relationships, that we're not co-creating this reality. And so you can see it in painting very clearly. It's like we're looking at this thing that is completely separate of us. And I think the VR headset is completely reproducing that. Is this idea that reality is already fixed, stable, and, you know, we're here to kind of grab objects in it, you know, this extractive mentality, and you can see it in the materiality of the technology itself, of the minerals, you know, it's, you know, all these minerals that are like extracted from the earth, you know, in Congo, through like child labor. So it's a whole system of that is, you know, based on an ideology, a way of thinking that is disconnected from the body. So I think for me, it always goes back to that. So that's why in my work, for example, I'm currently, you can see it in my studio, and that's the beauty of being in the studio, is that I can show you, for example, what I'm working on at the moment. I'm working on this VR experience, but because I really wanted with this project to use those technologies, to subvert them. It's really important for me to show that it's not all, I mean, it's messed up. We're in a really bad situation, but we also have agency. And I believe we can, you know, as you said, we can find interesting like syncretism or what I call also creolization. Creolization is a mode of resistance, right? And so what I'm creating with this VR experience, I'm creating this wearable. It's a digital waspy. Waspy is a word for these corsets.
Oh, a very, very, very small corset.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah.
And so we started with my collaborator, Marisa Di Munda, who's also working, a technician at Goldsmiths University, who's really interested in like textile, the kind of intersection between textile and technology, which is really fascinating, and so in relation to feminist theory. And we were thinking, okay, so, well, personally, my idea was to really decenter the VR experience, because for me, again, reality is not something that we just experience through our eyes, through our head, but mainly through the core of our body. In Tantra, actually, the essence of reality is breath. And, you know, we can go back to what the breath means. It's really deeper than lots of spiritualities. The breath is central. And a lot of the energy that you can generate in your body, and a lot, actually, embodiment, this moment in 2019 where I became in my body, is through the breath.
Yeah.
It's bringing your attention suddenly to the most subtle, the subtlest thing in your body, which is the breath. And so it's about decentering the eye. And so participants of this VR experience are going to be able to control the experience, to be in dialogue with the virtual world, the virtual landscape, through their breath. And so this was made with conductive yarn, with conductive rubber, which you can see inside, and which basically through your diaphragm, so deep belly breath, where your belly is expanding like a balloon as you inhale, and deep, and kind of like depleting as you exhale. So through that stretch, through that expansion and retraction, this creates like a float number, like a value that will be able to control then virtual or digital parameters. Yeah, I'm really hoping with that piece that people will be able to kind of experience how they are shaping reality. The controller is your breath. You don't have hand controller. So it's also really thinking like, you know, VR is the most ableist technology. And, you know, surely because those technologies are developed by white men in Silicon Valley, mostly. And so, you know, this is embedded within the kind of operational logic of those tools. And so, yeah, here anyone can, anyone that is alive, and you're alive because you breathe, anyone who's alive can experience this VR experience. And the idea is to really kind of counter also the logic of those technologies, which is, you know, hyperstimulus and making you, like, you know, boosting all your, like, dopamine and all these, like, hormones that will hook you and stuff. This is really going to be a contemplative experience that is designed to bring you into stillness, to bring you within, to bring you inward, to reconnect with your body.
Is there a risk with this kind of work that you end up essentially kind of accidentally becoming like a research department for Silicon Valley and coming up with, you know, alternative input controls and things like that? And how do you kind of maintain a level of criticality and, like, opposition? I mean, it's, again, another big question.
No, I mean, no, I'm smiling because actually I don't see that happening any day soon, to be honest.
No one's been knocking on your door.
You know, like, with my tantric thinking, and no, I don't really. I mean, actually, I think those, interestingly enough, like, those spiritualities are, people from Silicon Valley are really interested in those spiritualities.
Yeah. And there are plenty of, you know, like, meditation apps and apps, biofeedback apps and things like this.
And believing in manifesting lots of money, and which is something that you can do with Tantra.
It's obviously worked for them.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, for sure, it has been co-opted. It's constantly co-opted and used by those things. But for me, my work is really grounded in community. And and so, you know, the research at the foundation of it, actually, the first thing I did when I started the PhD journey is to create a community of research, so called Calicula. So why? Because, again, I was telling you, like, I'm guided by, you know, I start with myself, like, what are my experiences, what do I need to see in the world? And, you know, entering academia, I was already in dialogue, I was already teaching at Goldsmiths, but I could really see that I needed support through that research journey. That I needed, that academia was not providing the safe containers for me to hold that research. It was not there, you know, even, like, you know, the classrooms, you know, like, if we're thinking about the body and entering the body, you know, those classrooms, which, you know, they, like, build like hospitals, you know, it's like those really bright lights and uncomfortable seats. And if you want to, like, be able to enter your body and, like, kind of unfold its wisdom, you need to feel good, you need to feel comfortable, you need to feel at ease, you need... So already just that, the structures, but also the people that, you know, I was really lucky that my doctoral project is supported by Generation Delta, which is an initiative from the Black Female Professors Forum. And so I was the first me and Angela Loom were the first people, students, to get a Generation Delta studentship. And so that meant we were the first Generation Delta champions, and that means we created the PGR network for Generation Delta. So that meant we created like this beautiful network of racialized women who are on this doctoral journey. And, you know, seeing these spaces, how it was holding us, helping us to see the type of aggressions, and I don't want to call them microaggressions because I don't think they're micro. They're very real and actually quite challenging. But those aggressions that we were facing in that environment, in that Western academic environment, you know, also kind of inspired me that I needed the work I was doing needed its own container, needed its own space to be developed. And I needed a space also that was kind of safeguarded from the institutional gaze. Because also there was a tension for me that the research is really grounded in marginalized communities, knowledge and wisdom. And I'm not here to report that to the institution.
Mm.
Like for me, this doctoral research is more about redirecting the resources of academia to uplift community. So what we did at the very early stage with one of my interns, I had a research intern, Sibale, really amazing person from South Africa, really amazing researcher who was in the anthropology department, who kind of did an internship with me on this research project. And we launched Kalikulao. So we sent an open call to the community saying, okay, we want to create a space where we can rehearse those practices together. Mm. We can rehearse those emancipatory gestures and we can bring our wisdom together and we can have a space where we can feel all the repressed emotions, you know, because liberation for me is that. It's being able to re-enter your body when you've been forced to escape it. You've been forced ejected from it in some way. And like, so how can we support each other to like come together and redo that journey of reconnecting with those emotions that have been taboo, repressed, demonized, and embrace that, you know, like emotions like rage, you know, pain and grief, that together, and also celebrate that. So it's not just like darkness, but it's also exploring that shadow work, but it's also on the other side of that, it's liberation. It's like freeing ourselves from those emotions, understanding what they have to teach us, and be uplifted and enlightened.
Were you able to meet in person?
Yes, so yeah. Through Generation Delta, we applied with the Generation Delta PGR network, we applied for residency at Goldsmiths Center for Contemporary Art. They have a residence program, so they hosted us for 1 year. And so we were meeting in that space. So for me, this Kalikula was open to the collaborators, people who were working with me on developing this new performance called Your Rage is Sacred. I mean, new at the time. And open to the wider community so that we were in dialogue with it.
Mm. I have a related question, I guess, which is that because so much of your work, so much of your practice is about interior states and how, presumably, correct me if I'm wrong, but presumably how you're experiencing something and then how the audience is experiencing something. How does that translate? How do you kind of communicate that? Is it possible to make that permanent in the form of a PhD thesis that sits on a shelf somewhere in a library or online?
Mm.
How can you kind of, it's more than documentation, but how can you document, bring out, articulate, and kind of prove that these internal states are real and have happened for the purposes of kind of knowledge production?
That's really interesting, actually, because I had a conversation recently with my supervisor and she was like, you don't have to prove anything.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
she's like, you don't have to demonstrate anything. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not an Apple toy, you know? I thank her for that, actually. Mm. Audrey is amazing for that. Actually, going back to your question of academia, can it spoil it? I'm really lucky that my supervisor, my primary supervisor, Audrey, is really safeguarding that, the integrity of the project. So for that, I'm so grateful because, you know, I could have been misguided for sure, but she really believes in the project and, you know, and we're working together to keep its integrity. And so she said, yeah, you don't have to prove anything. And I'm going to continue I don't know if it's exactly what she meant, but the way I understood it as well is that the work is beyond the PhD. As I was saying, you know, I'm redirecting that towards community. When we create a space and we practice together, we all are elevated by what happened. We all learn from this moment and we all go back to our own spaces with that knowledge. So it's like a virus in a way, it spreads. And that's where the knowledge exists then. It exists in people's bodies, you know, the same way that this knowledge, the tantric knowledge has been carried by my ancestors through continents and through time. That's what happens. That's how it coexists and continues to exist.
So distributed knowledge, yeah. And do you think that your, your kind of artistic practice, has the PhD process been positive for that? Or have you found instead that you've had to sort of compromise it or slot it into a researchy box?
I think I'm really lucky that at Goldsmiths, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do it there, is that, you know, the type of practice-based PhDs that came out of Goldsmiths are quite experimental. Like, we've really experimented with the form, and I can see that there's, you know, infinite possibilities. And it's also a question, I guess, of the examiners that I'm going to invite and, you know, finding people that are sympathetic to this way of working. One thing that I will say is that I've often chosen spaces of resistance, where there's resistance, as a kind of, I think it can be generative, you know, to work against things. And often in my journey, you know, when I come to the end of something, it's like when I see I can't go further, you know, like I really hit the kind of point of tension over space and where they, you know, they can be experimental, they can be alternative, but at the end it's like, no, this is too much. I haven't reached that point yet with that project, but we'll see with the Viva how it goes. But maybe in the future I'd like to go into places where there's less resistance. I think I'm willing to test that in the future.
Brilliant. Okay, well, best of luck in your writing up year, and thank you so much for having me in your studio.
Oh, thank you so much for coming, Mark. That was a blessing.
My pleasure, thanks.